New year, new me! Forget it. And ladies, we need to talk. We're keeping it real. We're calling out wellness industry nonsense, Ozempic and its influence, and how our relentless striving for perfection is actually bad for us. So join us for the anti-New Year's resolution and start 2026 on the right foot. Search Ladies, We Need to Talk on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This conversation includes content that may be sensitive for some listeners. Please take care when listening.
Vince Hurley is here today. For 29 years, Vince was an operational police officer working in the outer burbs, investigating domestic homicides, assaults, home invasions, and drug trafficking. In that time, Vince was shot at, stabbed in the hand, and even pushed off a building. But perhaps the most challenging and often rewarding work he did was as a hostage negotiator, trying to literally talk people off the ledge or from crossing some kind of awful, disastrous, violent threshold by trying to make a human connection without knowing anything about that person. Today, Vince Hurley is an academic. He teaches at Macquarie University's Department of Security Studies and Criminology, where he brings his real-world experience to the job. And Vince is also a passionate advocate for policy reform on domestic violence. And just a heads up, Vince's story will have a great many things in it that you might not want the kids to hear if they're in the car with you or in the house at the moment. Hello, Vince.
Hello, Richard.
Where did life begin for you?
In the Blue Mountains in a place called Springwood. So I'm one of four boys. We're all a year apart and I'm the oldest.
Four boys.
Four boys, yeah.
Is that house still standing or did you tear it to pieces? Seriously.
Oh, poor mum. We laugh about it now and when mum was alive, but she had two nervous breakdowns trying to manage us four boys.
Seriously, she had? Seriously, yeah. Or are you joking?
No. Yeah, no, I'm serious. We didn't realise that at the time, but life for us amongst us four boys was either arguing or getting along exceptionally well. My four brothers and I, we all were quite close and we still are very close to this day. We talk to each other, you know, weekly at least. So we all grew up in this small town, Springwood, and then there's only two schools in the local area, the Catholics and the public school, and we were the Catholics, and I was terrified of the public school kids.
Really? I went to the public school. I was terrified of the Catholic school kids. Where I went to school, the Catholic school kids used to beat us up on the bus. They were hard because they were all like you guys. They were all used to fighting with their 14 brothers.
I deny having ever been there, Richard.
This is a different part of the world I'm talking about here, but nonetheless, it's pretty intense. How rough did the play get between you and your brothers?
Oh, look, there's a couple of vivid incidents that come back to memory. We were in the backyard one day and we had an air rifle, which are now illegal, but it was a legitimate air rifle. And in the backyard one day, my brother Patrick walked up to me behind my back in a point-blank range, fired a slug into my calf muscle, and it's still there to this day.
Oh, my God.
Mum, I told Mum, and Mum at the time didn't believe us, but many years later, I had an X-ray. I broke my leg. And the doctor said, there's a foreign object in your calf muscle. And I told Mum, she goes, oh, yeah, I vaguely recall something like that.
That's amazing. Tell me about the cubby house you had too,
yeah,
Vince.
Yeah, we had a cubby house. Dad used to bring home old timber boxes and we put them all together and strapped it to the wooden fence at home. And my other brother, Bernard and Patrick and me, we'd put metho all through it. And we lit it and right. Went, boosh! And the next door neighbour, Mrs. Seddon, who was about 80 years of age then, yells out, Molly, Molly, it's the boys, it's the boys. And called the fire brigade. It didn't totally burn down the fence, but it certainly damaged the structure rather severely.
Is there a kind of an odd kind of closeness that does get formed from that kind of rough sort of
jocularity
that goes on between brothers since you go through all that together?
Yeah, when I think back now, we really got along either really well or we just hated each other, yeah, as you do when you grow up. But I remember my brother Bernard got into a fight with a local bully and we all ran into the house and said, Dad, Dad, Bernard's in a fight with Colin. And Dad said, well, don't just stand there, go and help him. So Dad was, you're all in together, you know, to look after each other. But Mum came good. She was lovely, very compassionate, really compassionate. She saved us from many a belting from Dad.
Yeah, where was Dad in all of this?
Yeah, Dad worked long hours at a local butcher shop. He owned a family butcher shop, which is still there today. But Dad worked long hours. Like, he would be up at 4 a.m. and would go three times a week down to the Homebush Abattoirs, where the Sydney Olympic Park is now, and buy meat, bring it back. So he worked really long hours. Needless to say, his patience was sometimes right on the edge.
I was going to say, you do all those long hours and you come home and you say, what have those bloody boys done now?
And then if we were marking at the dinner table and Dad had a long day, as he normally would, he would rip off his belt and he'd get it out. And Mum saved us from many a belting below the waist, I want to stress, which he would gently put a hand on Dad's knee under the kitchen table and Dad would take a pause rather than belt us. So, yeah, it was. Look, it was, we were lucky, a fantastic environment, loved it. Dad was a very good work ethic.
What's your academic title these days? Are you Dr. Vince Hurley these days?
Yeah, I am.
So how was Dr. Vince Hurley PhD at school back in the day?
This is going to be somewhat embarrassing to admit on national radio, but I didn't do very well at school at all. In primary school, I was never a big achiever. I just didn't have the academic ability.
Was that the day when they used to sit you in the classroom as to where you finished academically?
Yeah. So I was in the last row in the last three seats. So, yeah, you're spot on, yeah.
Nonetheless, though, when you get put in that place, does that leave any kind of lingering effects on you? Does it kind of settle some ideas in your head for a while about who you are and how smart you are?
Yeah, definitely. I went to a Catholic primary school run by nuns. Some were exceptionally compassionate and some were exceptionally brutal. And there's a couple who I'll never forgive to this day for what they did to not only me but to my other classmates and girls. But when I was out of a couple of particular classes, a really compassionate nun took me and three other boys, and she took us into her sixth class, even though we were in fourth class at the time, to try and help us. And then she did that for the next couple of years. So she recognised that that wasn't the best environment for me and a number of other students.
Did you nonetheless think you had some kind of potential, though?
No, not really, to be honest, Richard. No, it was more of a day-to-day struggle. It wasn't until much later in the police that I started thinking, I wonder what it'd be like to go to university.
So what was your plan once you got out of high school?
I wanted to join the police straight away.
Why?
Because Mum and Dad thought it would suit my personality. Nothing to do with academia or anything like that. But very
the kind of guy who sets fire to cubby houses.
I went straight to the arson squad.
So poacher turned gamekeeper. Right. That's the idea, was it? Right.
Putting the monkey in charge of the machine gun.
Definitely for the New South Wales Police Force, this fella, in those days. I mean, seriously, though, why did you want to do it, though?
Because it was outdoors and it was exciting. And that's the only two criteria I had. And honestly, Mum and Dad thought it suited my personality.
So you went straight into the police force then?
No, Mum and Dad wouldn't let me. They made me work 2 years as a labourer before I went into the police to get a bit of life experience. So my application when I applied, when Dad found out that I'd applied, he contacted a friend of his who was in the police at the time and he had my application pulled, unbeknownst to me, and I couldn't work out why I hadn't heard back from him. And Dad said, well, actually, I've decided that you need a bit of life experience, which was excellent.
But do you think he was right?
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely, yeah.
Where did they put you after you graduated from police academy?
So when I was sitting in the room at the academy, you had no say where you wanted to go. And all my friends went to the Northern Beaches and to the Sutherland Shire and the hills. And then they said, Hurley, you're off to Mount Druitt. And I nearly shit myself. I thought, fuck, Mount Druitt.
Can you just explain, like, for people who aren't familiar with where Mount Druitt is, what it's like?
Yeah, so Mount Druitt is Sydney's outer western suburbs. It was then a very low socioeconomic area, second, third generation unemployed, high crime rate. When I went to Mount Druitt, there was probably 80% Indigenous population, a bit of Greek and Maltese, not many Anglo-Saxons at the time. Was then and still is now probably the busiest police station in New South Wales. Neighbouring that is Penrith and St Mary's, which is exceptionally busy. So it's medium density housing commission. And quite often the housing commission would be in very poor condition, no air conditioning. We used to call it Fibro Alley for that reason.
And what crimes were regularly being reported to you?
Oh, look, domestic arguments all the time, a lot of armed hold-ups, a lot of drug abuse, a lot of domestic violence, a lot of stealings. So really, for want of a better phrase, working-class crimes, no white-collar crime at all for things like that, because they were just poor individuals, poor people. Mandurah was a social experiment at the time, which was brought in by some sociologists who thought that if people lived closer together, they would get along better in harmony. But there was no infrastructure at all. Everything was by buses or they had to work. People didn't own many cars, or the cars that they did own, they stole from neighbours and things like that. I remember clearly I was working at Mount Druitt one morning. It was the middle of summer and it was a stinking hot Sunday. And this bloke's walked in and I'm the constable at the station. And he said, I want to report a stealing. I said, yes, sir, what's your name? I put the paper in the typewriter, started typing out. What's your name, blah, 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 where you live, blah, blah, blah. I said, what was stolen? And he said, my front lawn. And I said, and I paused, I went, what? And he said, my front lawn. What had happened? He laid turf on the Saturday afternoon. He went to bed, he opened the curtain on the Sunday morning, and overnight someone come along, rolled up the turf and stolen it.
So I suppose it's something you can't nail down, turf, isn't it? You can lay it, but you can't nail it down, therefore no. It's pinchable. Oh, oh dear. That's great. Vince, tell me about the day you went out on a call in Mount Druitt with your colleague Phil.
So Filthy Phil and I, as he was called, we got called to a Fibro Housing Commission house, and the bloke we knew there was Rory, was his name. And the police in Mount Druitt had been there hundreds of times possibly over the years. Well, we parked out the front and we walked up the drive and he stuck his head out the window. There were no fly screens on the house windows. He'd all punched them all out over the year. And inside there was holes punched through the wall. Anyway, we're walking up, he stuck his head out and Phil said, what are you doing, Rory? What are you doing? And he goes, oh, not much, not much. He's pulled his head back in. The next minute he's turned out with a shotgun and taken aim at Phil and I, let off a shot, and how he didn't hit us, I have no idea. We didn't even have time to unclip our holster, let alone get our firearm out. And we were just stunned. So we obviously got out of there, and he was charged with attempted murder. But it's the unpredictability of things like that in amongst all people stealing lawns that really makes you aware of how diverse society is and the risk of policing, because we never did anything to incite that. It was just a random thing. And when you got back to the station and composed yourself, you go, you know, I could be dead. Yeah.
How much was attending to scenes of domestic violence, the bashing of women is what we're talking about, really, a common factor in the police work at the time?
Then, like now, it would have been 80% of police work. I'm almost ashamed to say it, as I say to my students, the evolution of how police have dealt with domestic violence over the decades has been, you know, dramatically better, and so it should be, from what I did in the 80s. I went to 20 domestics in one night with a bloke by the name of Chris Clark, Shadow, who I still keep in contact with, in Mount Druitt. And it was just domestic after the domestic after the domestic. And there's no way, when you think about it now, that you can ever solve anyone's problem about a woman who was being flogged, and that's what it is in essence. But at the time in the 80s, it didn't have the social awareness that it does today. And when you look back on it now, I felt almost ashamed that there would have been women that I left and children in really vulnerable situations where I have no doubt after we left, they would have been flogged. And it's really embarrassing to say that, given my advocacy now on violence against women and girls. So,
what kind of things are you advocating for now, in regards to that?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of advocating on behalf of women and girls for domestic violence, or I call it violence against women and girls. If I had my way, Vince Hurley, I would remove the word domestic from that phrase, domestic violence. Because when I talk to school children between the ages of, say, 14 to 17, and that's when boys generally start developing personal relationships, whether it be with someone of the same sex or someone of the opposite sex, that's when they start forming their views. Now, when I talk to the school students, I've spoken to about 3,000, they see domestic violence as a bit of a private crime, because the word domestic in their minds insinuates a private argument between mum and dad or mum and a partner. If I had my way, I would remove the word domestic and just have straight out violence against women and girls, because sex is exactly what it is. It doesn't matter if it occurs at home. It doesn't matter if it occurs in the shopping centre down the street or at the footy ground. It's just straight out violence against women and girls. And I think that for boys, particularly between 14 and 17, who are start forming relationships, you've got to be able to cut through that soft general talk where it's not domestic violence. It's just straight out violence against women and girls.
This means attending to some seriously awful scenes, and I know your own welfare probably isn't front of mind in dealing with these things. That's the welfare of the woman or the girl or the victim in question. Nonetheless, it must have worn you down a bit.
Yeah.
Were you a drinker, or did you seek solace in other things? How did you...
No, I didn't drink in the police, actually, which automatically in the 80s...
Put you on the outer, right.
Yeah, I was. I was on the outer. Yeah. Yeah, I was. And it took a long time when I was at Mount George, then went to Blacktown, then St Mary's and Penrith, which is all in the same geographic area, the same socio-demographic area, to be accepted. But once you'd been in and had been known, Vince Hurley was accepted even though he didn't drink. But I remember going to a domestic. We were driving, myself and Aidan, down Sunday morning down a road at St Mary's, and a call came over the radio of a violent domestic taking place, and we just happened to be there. And then we stopped at the house, went inside, and there was a father who had a psychotic episode, had stabbed his daughter 10 times. And I've picked up we were just there, we called the Ambos. So I picked up the girl and I've walked out to the front yard, and she's literally taken her last breath in my arms. And now, being a father of four adult children, I think if I'd had children at the time, how would I have reacted? But I feel sorry for the dad, because he did have a psychotic episode and he thought that she was the devil, and he was found not guilty on grounds of insanity, which I don't doubt whatsoever. But, you know, when you see things like that, you think, what a waste of a human life. You know, that young girl and all the hundreds of thousands of victims throughout Australia, whether they be boys or girls or mums or aunties or grandmothers who are subject to horrendous violence, you think their true potential in society will never be known, because they are coerced and controlled by some shithead male. And it's beyond tragic, you know, and I genuinely feel for the women and for the girls and the young boys, because quite a lot of young boys and girls are murdered as a result of family violence. Their life could be so much better, and society could be a much better place.
So how do you find the resilience to keep coming back to work in that environment? Do you have to let yourself grieve rather than try and medicate yourself with whatever's lying around?
Yeah, I think mum was always really good, and dad. They did a lot of charity work, so that compassion element fed into my work, although I probably didn't realise it that much at the time. But mum and dad were really good at being able to sit down and talk to me about it. Now it would be called counselling, but mum and dad were really good at that. But I've always been into health and fitness, so I still go and do a lot of runs and go to the gym most days of the week. So the exercise would have been an out. Although, again, Richard, to be honest, I really probably didn't think about it all that much, because at the time in the police, that notion of psychological welfare really didn't exist at the time.
Today I'm with former police officer and hostage negotiator Vince Hurley. How did you move from there into hostage negotiation?
When I was in the police, I never had a career path as such. I drifted from job to job or from enjoyment to enjoyment. So I went into the police rescue squad for a while, and then I went into the detectives. I was there for 22 of my years. I went into an undercover drug unit. I went into the child sexual assault unit. But then an opportunity came up and I got to know someone who was a negotiator. And I thought, wow, that would be really fascinating. And what they do is they advertise for police, and they'll get, you know, say 2,000 applications for one or two positions.
Really? It's that popular?
Yeah, it is. And it's that incredibly hard to get into. And you will do probably 8 months of psychometric testing just to be accepted to say, well, you are of the right frame of mind. So then you start your training, and it takes 3 years of training to become a qualified negotiator. So I saw it certainly as a challenge to be able to go and deal with someone who was having, say, a psychotic episode or for suicide intervention. So it was the challenge more than anything at the time.
You mentioned your mum was a particularly compassionate person. Does she have a role in your being able to undertake this kind of work in your mind and the example she set?
Yeah, absolutely. Mum did a lot of work, charity work, when she wasn't putting up bushfires at home. She did a lot of charity work for the Catholic Care, the Lantern Club, the Deaf and Blind, some disabled groups, mainly in the Blue Mountains. She also worked in the later part of her life at a women's refuge in Sydney's outer western suburbs. She was 80 by this stage.
And how do you think that plays into the necessary work of hostage negotiation, that example?
Yeah, compassion. Compassion, empathy, and listening to people and seeing that everyone has a worth, but particularly the compassion part of it, because as a negotiator, it's never about you naturally. It's always about the person you're talking to. And I think in society generally, people often talk about themselves first without stopping and listening to the other person. It's about them. It's about them understanding what is going on. So for me, the compassion and the empathy of knowing that I'm standing in front of an individual who is in the absolute pit of despair. They can't see any other way out of their life or solving their problems is by death. And that's beyond tragic. That's horrendous. So Mum's compassion and Dad's work ethic fed into me and my brothers as well about everyone has a worth, everyone has a story to tell. It's not about you. You sit back and listen to people, and if you're in a position where you can help them, do so, but don't ever go looking for glory for it because you're doing it for the wrong reason.
You mentioned there's someone who's potentially suicidal, who's on the threshold of suicide. Yeah. That'd be one of the kind of incidents you'd be brought in to deal with. What other kind of situations would someone like you be brought in to deal with?
I remember going, get called out to Cobar at a, and started out as a really violent domestic. A man had had an argument inside the Empire Hotel. I'll never forget it, Empire Hotel in Cobar. He smashed a schooner glass and glassed his partner in the face. She fell to the ground. He then started kicking her, and she was 7 months pregnant, and she lost the child. And she was in a horrendous condition. She was flown by Royal Flying Doctor Service to Broken Hill Hospital. So we get called up there. He's gone out to a property, to a farm out at Cobar. We didn't actually go to the scene because he had a high-powered rifle at the time. So if you go there, he could take pock shots at you. But the local police knew who he was, so we isolated the phone and we called him. I said to him, there was two, Chris and I, and I said to Jimmy, my name is Vince, I'm a police negotiator. You were wanted for the horrendous assault on your partner. We want to talk to you. You are under arrest. Do you understand that? Fuck off your C's. And what you do as a negotiator is you let them vent. So in that situation for this bloke, we let him go for 20 minutes and I'm there, yeah. And those words like, yeah, okay, I understand, are fillers. And the fillers are just to draw out the conversation to emotionally exhaust him. So once he's emotionally exhausted, and you can tell by the tone of their voice and how aggressive they are on the phone, Chris and I think, well, okay, we're at a good point now where we might be able to make inroads into his conversation. So what we said to him was, okay, we're going to hang up now because this is not getting us anywhere. In 10 minutes, we're going to ring you back and pick up this conversation. So having that circuit breaker, we say, literally say, go and make yourself a cup of tea. Having that circuit breaker calms him down because he's already vented and he's emotionally come down. You can tell by the tone of their voice. And then he goes and has a cup of tea, which is something that he probably would normally do anyway, and a much more a relaxed state. So we would ring back and then he started again and we had worked up the strategy that he had 54 criminal entries for crimes of violence, like horrendous violence. And we had decided, Chris and I, that we were going to nip him in the bud straight away the second time and give him a bit of a reality check. Now, he was an Aboriginal man, and we said to him, now, we want to talk to you about this, okay? We want you to sit down. We want you to listen. It depends on the person, which depends on the strategy. And he goes, you fucking white fellas, all you come and do is do this, you've done that, you know, you're ripping me off, you hate me all. And he then went on a tirade of everything about, you know, being Aboriginal and me being white, besides the fact that I was talking to him from 2 kilometres away, he wouldn't know what I look like. Again, let him vent. And then I said to him at the end, I said, now you listen here to me. I don't know who you are. Okay, I didn't know you were Aboriginal, which I didn't at the time. I'm not here to persecute you. I didn't cause this crime. You can't blame me for all your problems. And he goes, you've got no fucking idea what it's like. And I said, that was the end. And I said to him, in a degree of arrogance, okay, you tell me what it's like. And then he's gone off on his life story about coming from a family of drunks, of domestic violence. So him challenging me gave me that in to say, okay, you tell me what it's like. And after 20 minutes of him telling me about his life story, he was fine. He was fine because he'd had an hour and a half of venting. And then by me asking him a question that was really relevant to his life story, and you've got to pick your time and moment, it felt as though that someone wanted to listen to him. You know he'd done the wrong thing, but he had not had the opportunity, as far as we could understand, to really explain about why he did what he did or his life story, how this contributed to it.
And when you say he was fine, do you mean he surrendered to police?
Yeah, he surrendered. He came out, surrendered to the police. And as we don't normally, as a negotiator, go and speak to the individual afterwards, some of them will say, can I meet you afterwards? And if you think it's safe to do so, with the advice from the tactical operations unit, the blokes in the black pyjamas, who are the ones that stormed the Link Cafe, they'll say, yeah, it's safe to do so. So I went and saw him afterwards, shook his hand, wished him all the very best. But it's really important as a negotiator, never lie. It's easier said than done. But as a negotiator, you never, ever lie. It's not like TV. And the reason you never lie is that you have to remember that lie. And if there is a changeover of staff, which invariably there is because they work 12-hour shifts, that crew then has to remember that lie as well. And if that hostage taker or that suicide person for suicide intervention discovers you've told them a lie, you've lost credibility. And they say, well, you've come here, you're supposed to help me, and now you've lied to me. And that will literally push them over the edge, no pun intended.
A warning that this part of the conversation includes discussion of suicide. Listener discretion is required.
What about attending someone who is on the ledge, so to speak, about to take some awful step to end their own lives? The previous case you mentioned, you tried to get the man in question to talk about what was bothering him. Would you ask that of someone on the point of taking their own life?
Yes, yeah, so you shouldn't ask that question, Richard.
Broadcast.
So I was called to a woman
conversations
who was going to jump off a cliff
with Richard
in the Blue
Feidler.
Mountains, and it was a 200-metre drop into the valley below. And what had happened was that the police at Katoomba were driving around one night. It was about midnight, and it was the middle of winter, and they just happened to drive down this particular street, and they saw her standing on the side over what was a safety barrier, and they've approached her and she hasn't been responsive to them. So eventually the negotiators were called, and well, I was the only negotiator available, so I went up to Katoomba. So we have to talk about personal space. So when you're talking to someone for suicide intervention, you don't want to make any sudden moves or moves that they might interpret to be threatening. So body language counts. And the way or the words that you use and the tone of the words that you use and even the spacing of the words and emphasis on the words really matter.
So does this mean you stand right back and you don't use coercive language? Is
that
what you're saying?
Yeah. So I approached her from the side so she could clearly see me. I didn't even know her name. And that's something that Netflix and Stan and all those things, any negotiation movie you see, they always know their name. You don't even know their name. So here's Vince Hurley walking into a woman's life, she's 25, knowing absolutely nothing about her and trying then to negotiate her back from jumping off this cliff. So you go and approach and make sure they see you. And I say, hi, my name's Vince. I'm a police negotiator, because I was in plain clothes. I'm a police negotiator. I'm not going to come any further. I just want to talk to you and find out what's wrong. What are you thinking? What's wrong? And when I first started, my friends would say, why would you ask a person who is standing on the edge of a cliff and going to jump off or holding a shotgun to their head, why would you ask them what's wrong? Because that would literally trigger them, no pun intended, to commit suicide. And the answer to that is that you are there to do a job. You are there to listen to that person. You are there for that very reason. You can't relinquish your responsibility as a negotiator. You are there to listen to the person to try and work out what's wrong. Now, I never had anyone commit suicide in front of me, but I know two other negotiators that I worked with at the time did, and they would never know if it was something that they said or something they didn't say or some type of movement. And to have that burden for those two individuals for the rest of their life is terrible. But I was fortunate I never had that experience. But I think that, as we mentioned earlier, it is about not you, it's about that individual. And if you show them you are genuinely interested, and that's a quality. Alpha males and alpha females will never get in to be a negotiator because it's all about them. There's a massive screening process to get in, so you've got to have the right disposition. But it is about generally that compassion and empathy we spoke about earlier.
So when you say it is a good idea to ask that person what's bothering them, then that, I suppose, implies that whatever crisis is going through that person's head, it doesn't get redoubled by talking about it. It gets alleviated. It dissipates. And what happened to this young woman in question you're speaking of?
So I asked her what had happened, and I estimate she did not say a word to me for about 4 minutes. Now, 4 minutes of silence is a long time. And I just stood there, and she was sort of half eyeing me, half not, and I just stood there. And after about 3 minutes, I said, I don't even know your name, if you can tell me your name, but don't worry, I'm not coming any closer. And I waited.
How frightened were you in those minutes?
You have to be really careful of what they call mission creep, of creeping in closer towards that individual. You have to make sure that in the back of your mind that you have a visual marker that you know that you don't physically pass, because if you get too close to them, they could grab you and take you over the edge.
I don't mean by that. I just mean that fear of her taking that step and you standing there to see this awful thing.
Yeah. Once you get the call, I always found this, once you get the call as a negotiator to go to either a siege or a suicide intervention, I used to think to myself in the car, don't kill yourself before I get there, don't kill yourself before I get there. All I want to do is get there and you still be alive. Because I believed, as all negotiators do, that you have the ability to bring someone back in off the edge and to make them see that life is worthwhile, no matter how dark a place it is.
So once you asked her name, did you then put that argument to her, life was worthwhile, or were you just standing and waiting for her to say something to you?
Yeah, I said, her actual name was Ingrid. She was a German backpacker. And I said, what's wrong? And she eventually said, my name is Ingrid, my boy's friends left me. And I said, that must be really horrendous. That must be really terrible. So you ask questions like what we call 5WH, who, what, when, why and how, all open-ended question to try and elicit information from them. So when I talk to my students in class, I will say who, what, when, why and how, because it's a two-way conversation. It's not threatening. You're asking them. And generally speaking, once a hostage taker or someone who's going to commit suicide starts telling you the story, you sit back and you listen and you try and pick up some positives from it. Like, for example, I remember with her, I said, well, you know, you've got family back at home. You've got sister back at home. You've got a niece and nephew back at home. You know, you have, in essence, you have things to live for. You know, relationships are heartbreaking. You wouldn't say, you know, you're not the only one that's gone through this. You wouldn't say that. But you say, you know, I understand how you feel. And as a negotiator, if you have been in that situation yourself, not suicidal, but being through a really bad breakup, you can say something like, look, I have a little bit, and I emphasise the word a little bit, of understanding of what it's like, because I've had something similar. Not the same, but something similar. So I understand how you feel. You must be feeling X, Y, and Z. And I go, yeah, I am feeling X, Y, and Z. So it's more about listening and then identifying with what they're saying.
It sounds like she's told you about her family back in Germany. She's told you this, she's told you that. And do you get a sense that whatever the kind of the thing that had been expanding within her was now starting to relax and contract?
Yeah, you do. You can tell by the change in their voice, the tone in their voice, and you can tell how much information they're willing to give you or offer you without you having to ask. So, again, it's like opening the floodgates for some of them. They want to pour out their life story to you.
And when you reminded her she had family back home, who of course would have been devastated, did she start to retreat? How did she, what happened? Did she actually retreat? What did she do?
No, she came back in eventually over the safety rail, because at that point in time, someone who's going to, when I was a negotiator, someone who's wanted to commit suicide, they're only focused on them and their problem. They don't see, understandably, about the other people outside their life who would be missing, who can make a positive contribution to their life. And I said to her, you know, this is only one part, eventually, this is only one small part of your life. You've had 20 years of a wonderful life. You've had a relationship breakdown, which is only a very small fraction of your overall life. And you'll go on to live a really profitable and fantastic life. And you'll meet someone else. So you give them hope. And that's true. You're not lying to them. You don't lie to them, and you don't be disingenuous about it. It's true.
How was it when she stepped away and climbed back over the rail? How did you feel watching that?
Very relieved, very really relieved, actually. And in fact, she is the only person that I did in suicide intervention for the 8 years I was a negotiator that came over and then gave me a big hug, which was really, really rewarding. It was lovely. I can still picture it now. So that was lovely. And that's amazing.
So we've talked about a situation where you might intervene where someone has performed some extremely dangerous criminal act. A second case here where there's some poor woman who's considering taking her own life. What about situations when the person you're trying to connect with is not really there, either due to some mental illness, psychotic episode, or to some kind of substance abuse?
Yep.
Were you brought in to deal with those kind of situations? And if so, how do you deal with that situation?
That's a good question. I have a number of times. I got called to a siege down in the Southern Highlands. This bloke was a hermit, and they knew that he had a couple of children, but the children hadn't visited for a while. And what had happened was that the neighbours had seen a young man walking around the house with a shotgun. So the neighbours were concerned. They called the local police. They went out there, and this young bloke has come to the front door with a shotgun, not pointed at them, but holding it, and his father was in the background. And the son said to the police, "I'm here to kill the devil." He was having a psychotic episode and he believed his dad was literally the devil. So the police were going, "Whoa, we're out of here." They surrounded the place discreetly and then called. I was a negotiator, and I was the only negotiator on at that time.
And so how do you then form some kind of bond of commonality with someone who's not in their right mind?
Yeah. So when I got down there, you get briefed from the local police. So sometimes they will know about that person and sometimes they won't. Sometimes there'll be intelligence holding about him, but no one knew about him. And the guy, just like the girl up at Katoomba, I didn't know her name. I didn't know this person's name either. So I feel sorry for the neighbours. So I got there at about 6 p.m. and my shift finished at 6 a.m. So I was on the PA and those poor neighbours had to listen to Vince Hurley trying to negotiate.
Loudhailer. Right.
So you try and listen to what they say to you to pick up a thread, if there is even a thread at all. Now, he was having a psychotic episode and believed his dad was the devil. So in that situation, for 12 hours, it was primarily just making sure that I was reinforcing to him, okay, your dad, this person, maybe he's just not quite the devil. So you would try and bring the temperature down. You would try and pick up words that he would use that would indicate some degree of weakness in his mind, and I don't mean mental weakness, I mean his train of thought, for an opening.
Oh, God, that's so subtle. That's fascinating. Yeah. So you don't say, you're fantasising, this isn't real.
No, no.
But you also don't go, yes, he is the devil, but you've got a buster catch or something. So you don't either fully reject or fully enter into his line of thinking.
Yeah, that's right, because you don't know, and as I say to my students about mental health or police dealing with use of force and mental health, you don't know, for example, I didn't even know his name, but for example, you don't know what medication he's on. You don't know if he's on one or two medications. You don't know if he's got diagnosed or undiagnosed mental health issues. You don't know if he's taken alcohol with that. You don't know if he smoked marijuana or if he's on ice. And the chemical reaction in his brain of all those things, you don't know if he's missed his medication and made up his medication the day before or if he's taken outdated medication. So when people talk about police shootings and mental health, which I study at uni, most police shootings happen under 30 seconds, and it's not possible for me to look at an individual and say, they've got a mental health issue. It's okay after the event, but going back to that siege, I didn't know what medication he was on. I didn't know when the last time he took it. So it's a matter of fine-tuning or trying to pick words, as you say, that give a degree of subtlety or a degree of...
Well, it's weakness in the argument, like you say. So what you're saying is this person in question in these situations, and this specific one as well, they've... with their own kind of distorted way of thinking, there is a causal chain, like this is true, therefore this must be true, therefore I must do this. And you're looking for something in that chain of thought that's weak in his mind.
Yes, spot on, yeah. And then once you find that, if that then is repeated, you know that what you are saying to him is preventing him from taking one step further.
How are you doing that in this incredibly dangerous and fraught situation? You know, that's the kind of thing, like, if I'm watching that on TV, I might go, oh, you know, I might be able to go, yes, maybe you could try that approach. But you're right in the middle of this, and you're doing that thing that is in the police dramas. I'm not speaking, I'm not doing all that. How are you keeping your presence of mind in that situation?
It takes a lot of concentration, absolutely. It takes a lot of concentration. And look, yeah, it's not thrown in at the deep end. It takes 3 years of training.
So you're engaging him with on his kind of... theory that his father is the devil in this case. Were you able then to weaken his resolve to go about doing this terrible thing? Or how did you then proceed from there?
Yeah, so I was talking to him for 12 hours, but he would only talk to me for probably on six occasions in 12 hours. As long as I never heard a gunshot, I knew that I was on the right path, because if I'd heard a gunshot, I would have thought, well, not only could I have probably done the wrong thing or gone down the wrong path, the fact that he hadn't shot his father was a positive indicator.
Yes.
And that's one of the indicators that you use as a negotiator, the degree of violence that a hostage taker inflicts on a person or whether they retreat. So the use of violence and threats is an indicator that negotiators use to gauge the mind of the hostage taker.
But you've been doing this for 12 hours now. Is the plan to exhaust him, really, and exhaust his resolve? Is that the idea?
Yes and no, because you don't know if he's on medication or
and
taking
things might get worse, right?
Yeah, medication in that time that he may not even, like if he's taking amphetamines, he wouldn't even feel tired. So what had happened was that I finished at 6 a.m. and I won't say her name because she's still in the police, lovely, lovely, just a beautiful person. She came down as a negotiator and she took over from me. And this is so bizarre. It just goes to show the mind of an individual. She came over and she took, I gave her a briefing. I went home to bed and then I went home, woke up a couple of hours later and I rang her and I said, what happened? And she said, he came out 10 minutes after you left.
So you were the problem then.
Well, funny you should say that because, and I said, why? He said that he didn't like the sound of my voice. Literally. That I kid you not. So, yeah. And everyone lived happily ever after, thank God.
So October 2010, Vince, you retired from the police service. What led you to want to retire? Because you're still a man who's quite in good health and in fine condition, I would have thought. What brought about you wanting to leave the force?
So I was working uniform at St Mary's in Sydney's outer western suburbs. I was driving down the Great Western Highway by myself. It was a Sunday. All these things seemed to happen on a Sunday. I got a call come over the police radio. The three young men or youths had flogged an 80-year-old man and stolen his wallet. Ended up being for $20, God. And I'm just driving down, and they've literally run across the road in front of me, like literally. And I've gone, shit, that's them. That's them. I couldn't believe it. So I pulled up, and I've chased. I'm going, stop, police, stop. You know, as if they couldn't tell I was a police driving a marked car, lights and sirens and wearing a uniform. And I've chased them into an industrial site because they're half my age. And I chased them.
And there's three of them?
Yeah, there's three of them.
And have you got anyone with you?
No, I was by myself. I was the boss. I was the boss at the time. I just happened to be there. But anyway, and I've chased them in, and I've chased them up to a second-story construction of a house. And then, so run up the concrete stairs a second. I've got to the second story, and there's a gap of probably a metre and a half between me and them. And they've cornered me. They turned around and cornered me, and I was, shit, I've got nowhere to go here. So then I've tried to run and I've slipped on a bit of cement sand to try and get away from them, and they've just pushed me off the building. And I fell 2 stories onto a slab of concrete, and there's not much give in a slab of concrete. I got a fractured skull, 3 vertebrae, my spine were crushed, fractured ribs, broken, fractured left leg, a whole host of injuries. So that was one incident of a number of over the last 10 years or previously that I'd been. I was driving a police car and a semi-trailer hit me. I got bashed up in that. In the early 2000s, I got stabbed by a prostitute with a bloodful syringe. She carved open a pat of my thumb. So the insurance underwriters of the police said, "You're becoming too much of a medical liability for us. Your last day is the 28th of August, it was, and you'd have no right to appeal, because when I joined under the Police Act of 1975, the Police Act at that time had no provision for occupational health and safety to retrain me, relocate me, or find me another position. So I was discharged, and I would have loved to have stayed at least for another 7 years, even if it was light duties, because I just loved it, just loved work.
Just seems a bit odd that you had to be discharged for valour in the line of duty, you know, chasing after 3 really nasty people who pushed you off a building and then stabbed in the thumb with a full syringe. Are you all right after that? Were you contaminated with anything from that syringe?
I had to go to the AIDS clinic at Westmead Hospital because she had hepatitis C, ended up getting hepatitis C out of it. We were worried that she might have had not only AIDS in it, but a bit of heroin in it, because she was a heroin addict, but no.
So you made the transition to university life. That's
far more genteel.
Far more genteel, but nonetheless must be a lot less stressful, a lot more peaceful, or isn't it? Is it? I don't know a lot of happy academics these days, I got to say. How are you finding life on the campus?
Look, academia is the world's best job, and a lot of my colleagues, what I find, and they all are wonderful people I work with, they have nothing to compare academia to. So I've lived the life that none of them have ever lived. And I've been shot at and I've been stabbed and
Pushed off a building.
So for me, having that baseline of policing experience or life experience outside of academia is an amazing thing. And I love what I do. I teach about criminology and policing to students. I just absolutely love it. But what I find really fascinating about uni, even in the 15 years I've been there, is that university is supposed to be this place, this institution that inspires ideas and thoughts without people arguing. But I found that, generally speaking, academia, the debate around ideas has become shrunken. It's very insular now, but people are too afraid to express an idea for fear of, for want of a better phrase, political correctness. There's nothing wrong with disagreeing. People should be able to disagree. Yep. Inciting hate speech is something completely different. But the notion of university to push the boundaries of a student's intellect and to make them a better citizen from when they arrive to when they leave, that is, for me, that's the essence of what universities are supposed to do. And I fear that has been massively diluted.
Are you saying that as someone who is a former hostage negotiator, you feel like you're walking on eggshells in this job? That's amazing.
It'd be easy to negotiate with my 4 children sometimes, I think.
What do you miss about police work?
I get asked this question a fair bit. I'm asked about driving fast cars and kicking in doors. I miss the action. I miss the symbolism of policing. I miss putting on the uniform, because that was part of my identity. And I love the police culture. There were a lot of bad things about the police culture in the 80s and 90s, without a doubt. But it's changed dramatically. And one of my daughters wants to join the police, wholeheartedly support it. But I do miss the camaraderie. I do miss the dark humour. And I will crack jokes at work about, you know, something. It'll be dark humour, but they won't find it the slightest bit amusing. I think you've been here too long. But I do miss, it's a totally different culture. But whenever I hear a police siren or I look at a police vehicle and it's got their lettering on it, you know, they'll have a lettering on it, that will indicate where they're from and what type of duty. I go, oh, that's RY10, that's Ride 10. That means that person is the shift supervisor. I wonder what's happening in Ride today. So I do miss that, yeah.
Wow, it's been completely amazing speaking with you, Vince, and hearing your extraordinary life story. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Richard, the pleasure's been mine. Thanks very much for the opportunity.
Vince Hurley now teaches at Macquarie University in their Department of Security Studies and Criminology. Today's conversation with Vince Hurley was made on the lands of the Gadigal people. Producer was Maggie Morris. Executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.